This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Hoida Araf of the International Solidarity Movement, who's just back from Lebanon.
She's a real hero. In the midst of the bombing of Lebanon, she flew to Beirut to try and organize a civilian presence and take it south into the very heart of the bombing of Lebanon.
We'll talk about the federal court striking down the NSA warrantless surveillance program.
Hopefully, this decision will be upheld. It's a real blow to the emerging police state this government has been trying to impose since 9/11.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Katrina disaster.
Despite the damage caused by that disaster, little or nothing has been done by our government to make the lives of people any better. In fact, it's getting worse.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Hurricane Katrina disaster, the Category 5 monster hurricane that pounded the Gulf Coast, killing more than 1,300 people and leaving hundreds of thousands displaced. In New Orleans, more than 200,000 people have not been able to return home. Internally displaced people have an international human right to return to their homes, and the government has a responsibility to help them do so. This process is not yet fulfilled. Environmental human rights also pose serious risks, as New Orleans residents have been urged by government agencies to move back into their homes, this despite contaminants that have leached deep into the soil and mold that contaminates the air. According to Reuters, Asian tsunami relief workers who visited New Orleans this summer were shocked at the lack of recovery. We're joined today by Executive Director of Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights, Jeribu Hill. Jeribu Hill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Drew, it's been a year since the Hurricane Katrina disaster really wiped out the Gulf Coast region. Can you tell us what has changed and what hasn't 1 year later?
Well, unfortunately, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of rebuilding actual lives of people who were the most affected, not much has changed. Still far too many people are living in FEMA trailers. Up until about 2 months ago, people were even still living in tents, and we're told that there are still some tent sightings on the Gulf Coast, particularly in East Biloxi and also in New Orleans as well. In addition to the problem, no housing for people who lost everything, there's also the issue with health care. There's the issue with school children who were out of school for close to 2 weeks before being able to return to the classroom and having no supplies, having no resources when they return, and the ongoing problem of joblessness, where workers literally lost their jobs because their jobs went underwater. And at that time, particularly in the Mississippi Gulf Coast region, some 3,000 casino workers had just been unionized through the grand casino industry. Of course, they all lost their jobs and any hope of any job security for the near future. Then you have hundreds of people who still are reported missing. You have people who are missing and presumed dead, like the 60 or so Jamaican women who were domestic workers in Biloxi working for the Grand Casino, who had no transportation of their own and had to be picked up every day by their employer and returned home every day by their employer. And apparently they were not picked up. They are presumed to have been buried alive in the rubble. And so those kinds of horror stories continue to mount up and continue to be glaring evidence of not only the benign neglect that we were experiencing right after Katrina, but the continuous benign neglect in terms of accurate accounts of where people are, in terms of accurate statistics, in terms of people being able to participate in even conversations that would lead to their full participation in the rebuilding efforts, if in fact there are any real rebuilding efforts. We've seen mostly development efforts around casinos getting back up and running and business people getting their pockets lined again, but we have not seen any evidence of an all-out campaign to build decent and affordable housing.
I understand that the government uses the figure of $44 billion as what's been designated for the rebuilding project or the rebuilding effort. Have you seen that money come into the community?
Well, from what we've seen, we would categorically say no, we have not seen that money, nor have we seen the plan for how that money is going to be spent. We recall 2 months after Katrina, Haley Barbour, governor of Mississippi, started having meetings. These meetings were exclusionary meetings, meetings where developers, architects, politicians, and the like were invited to these closed meetings. And in fact, when people called to find out about the meetings and get an itinerary or a schedule of where the meetings were going to be, they were told that the meetings were closed to community people and closed to the press. Only after forcibly pushing our way on to be invited to one of the meetings did Haley Barbour finally allow people to come to one of the meetings. And when we got to the meeting, the interesting thing was that even during the Q&A, it was so controlled that people were not even able to ask their questions. Their questions were read out, and then they were told that experts would contact them with the answers. And, of course, no one has ever been contacted with the answers to their questions. And so for us, we still see the same lockout, the same exclusionary policies that were in place before, and the same grinding poverty overall on the Gulf Coast. If you look at the casino culture, yes, there are people who go there and gamble, but you also know that amidst that playland kind of atmosphere and Disneyland type atmosphere, there is grinding poverty, low wages, and conditions that have been unbearable even before Katrina and are now even more unbearable.
If I could go over the figures for a second, as I understand it, $110 billion has been designated in total for the rebuilding project. They said out of that, $44 billion has already been spent. A total of $77 billion has been released, and $33 billion is earmarked for future rebuilding efforts. So $77 billion has been released, and the people of the Gulf Coast don't even know to whom this money has been released?
Yes, that is in a nutshell, and you've described the problem to a T, because what we are demanding is not only an accounting of how the money is being spent, but we're demanding actual plans for actually putting people's lives back together. And how do you do that without putting people back in housing? How do you do that with making sure that employers keep their word about reopening businesses and putting people back to work? The government cannot talk about the total amount of money being allocated without also talking about how that money is going to be spent, who is going to be doing what. And looking at the contractors that are brought into the Gulf Coast region, mostly from the outside of the region, coming in and exploiting workers by not paying them. If they don't speak English, if they are Spanish-speaking workers, they are sure to be told that they're not going to get the full top dollar that they deserve, or they're not going to get paid at all. And so you have groups like the Mississippi Immigrants' Rights Alliance fighting for back wages and fighting for wages that were not paid and getting employers to release some $600,000 in back pay for people. So profits are being made, but the people who are benefiting from those profits being made are the business concerns and not the sufferers. We see a situation where it's a powder keg. We see people living hand to mouth, barely making ends meet, not knowing when they're going to be put back in their homes, living in trailers. The tension is mounting. We see no direct, tangible relief, and we see no real response from government. We see only Band-Aid solutions. We don't see the kind of major surgery that needs to take place.
What are some of the biggest challenges that the Mississippi Workers Center has been working on?
We worked on two fronts. One, we started out working right away on the issue of race and class disparity with respect to the way the resources were dispensed. And everything that you heard about the way the Red Cross and FEMA went about their daily work is true.
Revisit that for us.
Yes, we were in East Biloxi right after the storm, and we saw horrible images of destruction and disruption of people's lives. And we saw the same images that you see when you go to the Ninth Ward. In fact, East Biloxi is our Ninth Ward. We also saw the disparities in terms of the difference in even in terms of the shelters. The shelters that were located in East Biloxi were substandard. The shelters that were located in D'Iberville, which is a middle-class community, fairly racially mixed community, were not substandard. In fact, the Red Cross station in D'Iberville had, not only was it state-of-the-art, it also had a health clinic on site. The Red Cross station in East Biloxi had a cardboard sign on we went there, and we were shown the sign that said 3 meals a day. It was crossed out 2 meals a day, and then there was a cross out that said 1 meal, and then there was another cross out that said 0 meals.
Jeribu Hill, I just want to remind our listeners, you're the executive director with Mississippi's Workers' Center for Human Rights. Have you had any experience with the Small Business Administration, loans, insurance companies, both government and business, not doing what they should do to help these people?
Yes. In fact, we represented a couple of people who had been told, in lieu of getting insurance benefits, they should apply for these small business loans to get homeowner mortgages paid off. And, of course, that was misinformation, and we prepared and filed some complaints with the Better Business Bureau to that effect. But also, we have just seen rampant insurance denials where people should not have been denied and where they have been denied. At one point, the Attorney General Jim Hood of the state of Mississippi declared a moratorium on insurance denials through a TRO that he filed. But that did not stop insurance companies from still going ahead in some cases and denying people benefits where they had been paying premiums for 30 years plus. And suddenly they were told, oh, it was a flood and you didn't have flood insurance. Well, it was a hurricane, and a byproduct of the hurricane was the rushing waters. And now you're going to say that this is just an ordinary flood, and you're going to deny people coverage and recovery that they're entitled to and that they've paid for. You see a lot of fraudulent conduct on behalf of insurance companies and some of the building organizations.
Drew, but a lot of people for the first time have come to understand after Katrina that human rights violations happen in the United States. Can you tell us how human rights violations have occurred in the whole Katrina aftermath?
Yeah, and I'm amazed that some people actually, and I look at them and I know that they're not lying when they say to me, my God, I didn't know this kind of stuff was going on in America. But yes, you're right. Some of the most stark examples have been the treatment of workers, particularly immigrant workers, particularly low-wage African-American workers. For example, in the shipyard, the Northrop Grumman shipyard, workers were told to come back to work a few days after the hurricane. They were told to come back regardless of the shift that they worked on, to come back on the day shift. When they reported to work, there were no lights. There were generators and very, very dimly lit buildings and quarters that they were supposed to work in. They were tripping and falling. There were serious accidents that occurred because workers were forced to come back to work before the facilities were even up and running again. And they were threatened with come back to work now or we'll assume that you don't want your jobs. We've seen human rights violations around issues concerning working without pay in the form of what we would call involuntary service. Because the last time people worked for free was in slavery. But they've been working people pay because they're very vulnerable in terms of their immigration status, or they perceive them to be vulnerable because of their immigration status. One of the most stark examples of human rights violations, because we do believe it's not just a cliche when you say housing is a human right. The very basic level of subsistence has to do with where you live and how you live. And so the quality of life issues that people have had to face are certainly related to the human rights abuses that they've had to suffer. Then the failure of government to allow people to participate is another human rights abuse, because we know that you have a human right to participate in government. And once you elect your officials, which is also a human right, you have a right to expect that they're going to be accountable to you and that they're going to involve you in the processes. And we see that that cannot happen as well. To add insult to injury, we see stark abuse and misconduct like you wouldn't believe. People being rounded up and accused of looting simply because they procured food. Their children were about to go hungry and criminalized because they were in the midst of a storm. When you saw the image of the white couple coming and saying they had found food and the African-American man who had found food being called a looter. It's true, the double standard, the racism.
There were two captions from two Yahoo pictures where white people taking food were described as people finding food and black people taking food were described as thieves who were stealing and looting. We're so happy that you were able to join us. Drew Buhum, Executive Director of the Mississippi Workers' Center. Please tell our listeners, what is it going to take to change the situation and how can they participate?
People are going to have to mobilize like they've never mobilized before. It's going to take serious organizing combined with really progressive advocacy, and that there has to be a response across the country. There has to be a series of direct actions where people are challenging their state houses about Katrina rule, because you have displaced people scattered across the country. And so this is in all of our interest to raise these issues in solidarity with people who have been pushed out and discarded the way that they've been, that we have to see this as an issue that affects everyone and not just people who live on the Gulf Coast. We have to challenge this government in ways that we've never challenged it before. Progressive legal organizations like the Guild and human rights organizations like Amnesty. And now more than ever, we have to step up to the plate and to see what kinds of things we can file. What can we take to the Inter-American Commission? What can we take next time we go to Geneva to show the human rights abuses that the U.S. continues to allow in this country, the difference between the way people treated after the tsunami and after 9/11 and now? These are stark differences. These are stark representations, because New Orleans was a predominantly black city, how people were allowed to just simply die by drowning it. And that happened because of the race divide that we continue to experience. And racism is a human rights abuse, because the first principle, as we all know, is the right of equality. And some people have denied that right since birth. And we have to fight for human rights in this country like we've never fought for it before. Katrina is a glaring reminder of the continuing and ongoing human rights abuses right here in the richest country in the world.
Jeribu Hill, Executive Director with the Mississippi Workers' Center for Human Rights, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're joined by Charlene Espinoza, author of Through the Eye of the Storm, a book dedicated to rebuilding what Katrina washed away. Charlene was the second woman ever to fly a U-2 reconnaissance aircraft for the U.S. Air Force. She's currently a captain flying for United Airlines on Airbus 320 and 319. She's been down 10 times to Mississippi, where she's involved in building a community center, and we're very happy to have her on Law and Disorder. Charlene Espinoza, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've written this terrific book called Through the Eye of the Storm. You've been down in Mississippi working to try to help. And we wanted to ask you, going back a year now, what kind of progress you think has been made down there, and what kind of legal problems are people having in trying to get things back to normal?
Michael, from an individual standpoint, not a lot of progress has been made. For the most part, people are either living in maybe one room of their home or in a FEMA trailer or some type of a temporary structure, a tent even. And the reason is simply that most of the people that we've worked with in the Gulf Coast around Gulfport, Pass Christian, and DeLille are working Americans, but they have very little margin for any kind of economic uncertainty. They can little replace a car battery, let alone an entire home. And they were insured for the most part, but as you know, and we can talk about, the insurance claims have been very slow in coming or not coming at all. And so they really had to shoulder the burden of rebuilding on their own backs. And as a result, they're still in FEMA trailers as they're trying to collect what little money or volunteer work they can to rebuild. The debris removal is surprisingly gone relatively quickly in terms of the cleanup. But like I said, if you don't have housing, it's very difficult to move on with your life on any level.
A lot of these folks had insurance for a natural disaster like this. Why haven't the insurance company paid up?
That's a great question. I have a chapter on insurance in the book, Through the Eye of the Storm, and damage is not covered, essentially. And what the argument is that, for example, if people have hurricane insurance, then it is all based on wind-driven rain. So, in other words, if the wind comes and blows off part of your roof and you get some rain damage, then theoretically that's paid for. But in reality, it's really just the roof that's paid for. The water damage, as it turns out, many policies had a mold exclusion, which is sort of a fine print exclusion. And so even if what they call concurrent damages, which sure, you lawyers know a lot more about that than I do, the case history on that, dating back to really the California mudslides, was that the insurance industries sort of got away with this notion of concurrent damage. So the initial peril, the roof, is covered, but not the subsequent mold. And the mold grows so quickly there that essentially that's what's taken down most of the homes. In fact, one of the families that we worked with, Chantrell Nick, she's an attorney in Gulfport, and initially they thought their house was okay, but one side of it was water-soaked, and the subsequent mold destroyed essentially the entire house.
The cost difference, Charlene, is huge. Like, you might get $10,000 for a roof, but $130,000 is what you're out for the destruction of the house. So you're talking about people really having their economic well-being and their houses destroyed.
Yeah, and exactly. Having mold in a house, for the benefit of our listeners, it's a poison. Yeah. There's various kinds of mold. Some of them are benign. Some of them make you very sick, very, very sick. You can't live in a house with that kind of mold poisoning, and it's real hard to get rid of it. A lot of those houses
are
torn down.
People are living in a toxic wasteland down there. What's your assessment of the environmental damage and the health effects that are caused by it?
That's a great point, Dahlia, and it's sort of overlooked many times. And talking about concurrent damages, there's also concurrent health effects. For example, they've had a rash of various bugs floating around, stomach bugs, respiratory infections. The death rate is 3 times as high as it was. In fact, a man who runs the Pratt Whitney rocket test bed for the space shuttle, he lives in a trailer, and he also sits on a nonprofit board, the Gulf Coast Recovery Foundation, and they have said that the death rates have tripled. One of the men that I write about in my book, very healthy, fit, 60-year-old African-American man, dropped dead about a month after the storm. Just I think a lot of stress, too, is taking its toll, I should say, on their health. And most of the families that we know, the kids have had some real serious respiratory and gastrointestinal problems. And they're playing, really, in a toxic waste dump. And that's one of the many reasons why we feel strongly committed to building this education center and aquatic center, swimming pool, in Pas Christianas to give the kids a place to play safely.
They're also living in toxic waste, and people have been encouraged to come back and to move back and to rebuild in areas that the EPA has not adequately cleaned up and that are not safe for human inhabitants. And what I really am concerned about is the health impacts that we will see years into the future, things that cancer does not show up overnight. There are many diseases that take years and years to show up or get, you know, or alter DNA and end up, you know, unfortunately affecting your genetics.
I think you're right. And here again, it really goes back to leadership, Dahlia. I mean, these are difficult decisions to be made, whether they're in New Orleans in terms of where are you going to rebuild, how are you going to clean up that area, and does it make sense in certain areas given the cost of to fully fortify the levees or rebuild the levees? And in Mississippi on the Gulf Coast, does it make sense to put your house right back there where it's in danger of getting another tidal surge or another hurricane damage? I mean, obviously, where we've bought land to build this education center is far inland away from that. But these are decisions that have to be made on some government level to either say, yes, it's safe, and yes, you can rebuild here because you can buy insurance, and this is a good place to rebuild. But most of the time, the politicians are just very hesitant to number one, make a decision, and number two, properly invest in the cleanup as well as the fortification of that area.
We're speaking with author Charlene Espinoza, who has written Through the Eye of the Storm. It's a book dedicated to rebuilding what Katrina washed away, and the proceeds from Through the Eye of the Storm are going to be used for a community center down in Mississippi. Charlene, what's the website?
It's called, it's very creative, ThroughTheEyeOfTheStorm.com. Easy to remember with the book, and you can see some drawings, renderings of the community center, as well as listen to some of the chapters and find out how to help if you're interested in either volunteering or donating goods or services or money to the project.
Charlene, about a year ago when this disaster occurred, I was in Indonesia, and I was watching it on a loop on world news, and the world press really classified this as a situation, a disaster with grand race and class implications. And when I came back to look at the U.S. coverage, I was really shocked that there were not the same kind of critical analysis on a race and class level. How is the recovery and what you've seen in the past year, the efforts? Can you tell us from a race and class perspective how that has all played out?
I think that, I mean, your characterization certainly is true, and I think that on a mass level, we had this window of opportunity while people felt, at least I did, a deep sense of shame, and perhaps that's part of my motivation in initially going down there, that look, you know, what can I possibly do, as though it was a moral imperative. But then what happened, I think, is it sort of degenerated into this dysfunctional playing field whereby people were essentially making the people of the Gulf Coast less than. I talk about that in the book, in a chapter about race called A Dream Spoken, a tribute to Dr. King. But if you make someone less than and say, well, this is their fault because they didn't leave New Orleans, or they didn't have insurance, or because they're black, or they're poor, or they're better off anyway, as one former First Lady said of this situation, then it sort of legitimizes your inaction. But I think as I've traveled around the country, people still are very much disturbed by what happened in Katrina, and they don't know how to help. And all the type of, you know, the coverage about the corruption, the graft that came out of this is dissuaded many people from being involved.
We want to remind listeners, you've written this really wonderful personal memoir of your experience down there, Through the Eye of the Storm, published by Chelsea Green. It's a book dedicated to rebuilding what Katrina washed away. The proceeds for the sale of the book are going down to the community center that you and your family are putting up. We really applaud you for your wonderful work and the spirit you brought to this, and encourage our listeners to read it.
I want to say one word, Charlene, because I know one of the things you guys are involved in is the building of a swimming pool, which is going to be the first swimming pool in southern Mississippi, in the Delta. I think that's a public mm-hmm. pool. Is that right?
Yes, it is. There's from basically Gulfport to Louisiana state line, about 60 miles, there are no public swimming pools.
Right, and I want to give people a story of why that's the case. You know, I've been at the Center for Constitutional Rights since the early 70s. And in 1974, I was there when Bill Kunstler argued a case in the Supreme Court called Palmer v. Thompson. And as people may recall, is after the Supreme Court said you couldn't desegregate the schools, what followed from that was that you had to desegregate the schools. You couldn't keep them segregated. What followed from that was, of course, the desegregation of public transportation, hotels, and public swimming pools. And what they did in Mississippi, and probably some other states, is rather than desegregate the swimming pools, is they closed all the municipal swimming pools because they didn't want blacks and whites swimming together. And they closed them in Mississippi. The Center for Constitutional Rights with Bill Kunstler went to the Supreme Court and said, that's just another form of segregation. You can't simply close the pools because you don't want blacks and whites swimming together and then separately set up private white pools, even though they're not with public money. And the center lost the case 5-4 in the Supreme Court. It was the first case we'd lost in the civil rights movement and sort of the beginning of the end of that movement in the South. And since then, really, there were no desegregated pools built in southern Mississippi. So this effort to put in actually a desegregated swimming pool is a pretty big break, but it just shows you what kind of long history there has been of that kind of racism in that, particularly in the Delta.
We thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you, Michael and Dahlia. And if it wasn't for people like yourself, then there wouldn't be light shed on, as Dahlia has pointed out, well, the injustices down there. And we hope to be able to address the root cause of that through this community center. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
That was author Sholene Espinoza, who's written Through the Eye of the Storm.
Today, we are pleased to have with us Hawaita Araf. Hawaita is the founder of the International Solidarity Movement, which was a movement founded to give solidarity with Palestinians, particularly in the occupied territories. She has spent the last several weeks in Lebanon, establishing an international civilian presence and supporting Lebanese civilians in confronting the Israeli aerial bombardment in southern Lebanon. She also recently this summer was a worker at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She's a third-year law student, and we're really excited she is back home safely from Lebanon. Welcome, Hawaita Araf, to Law and Disorder. We're really pleased to have you. I know we tried to reach you in Lebanon last week and missed you, but you're back.
I am back. I understand it was difficult getting through to us sometimes in Lebanon. I'm sorry about that, but it's good to be with you.
Hawaita, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you went to Lebanon.
I, in general, consider myself a human rights activist and worked for a few years in the occupied Palestinian territories and saw firsthand the effects of Israeli aggression, occupation, and the tremendous level of violence that is used to maintain the occupation and to expand territorially. Now I'm in the United States studying international human rights and humanitarian law, and when the aggression started in Lebanon, I felt I had to go. And particularly because something I forgot to mention, in Palestine, I was a co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, which mobilized civilians and worked with Palestinian grassroots activists and international civilians that would come to the occupied territories to use nonviolent methods and tactics, strategies to confront Israeli occupation and campaign for an end to the occupation.
Our listeners, Hawaita, will probably be familiar with ISM, particularly because we've covered the Rachel Corey case, and I think Rachel was a member of ISM, is that right?
Yes, she was. With that same spirit that my husband and I and another couple of human rights activists decided to go to Lebanon to see if there was any utility to having an active international presence in Lebanon. And we were communicating with Lebanese over the internet about the possibility of coming and what could be done, and they strongly encouraged us to come. And we went with a small group first and met with representatives from NGOs and Lebanese activists about trying to move from the kind of civil resistance that was happening since Israel aggression on Lebanon began, which mainly concentrated on relief efforts and taking care of the displaced, the large number of casualties from Israel's bombing, into more actively confronting or using civil disobedience or direct confrontation to challenge Israel's aggression. And it might seem crazy to some because they were just dropping bombs all over the place, but this was the nature of our question in going.
It did seem amazing to me. I want to have an admission here. You know, when Huerta left, Huerta was working at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I mean, I was shocked because of the high risk you were taking. Here you were sitting at the semi-comfortable center in New York, and you just got on a plane and flew to Beirut. You got off the plane there. You met with various people. And first of all, what did you decide to do?
When I arrived, I was pleasantly surprised. Aside from all of the destruction, which was horrendous and devastating, but the spirit of the people was really encouraging and something that I had not expected following the devastation and the brutality of the, you know, the nature of the attacks and the large number of casualties and destruction. But the people were very steadfast and determined. And we first arrived in Beirut. Central Beirut wasn't hit and people could move. But at the time I arrived, Beirut itself had taken in nearly 500,000 displaced persons, people that were fleeing from the south, which was being heavily bombarded. And different organizations had gotten together and formed coalitions and were taking in these displaced people and organizing to care for them. And people were mobilizing to form international coalitions, get international support. Other people were doing media work. And so the spirit of resistance and resilience was inspiring. Only hours after we landed, we had a large meeting with different representatives. And the possibility of moving past that kind of relief and steadfastness to direct action, confrontation, was discussed. And people were, Lebanese civilians were excited about it, but at the same time, very, very skeptical. They knew of my experience in Palestine and kept stressing that it is very different from what's happening in the occupied Palestinian territories, because for the most part in the occupied West Bank, at least you see the soldiers, you're in active confrontation on the ground. And while there is aerial bombardment, especially in Gaza, most of what we face and what I experienced in Palestine was dealing with soldiers face-to-face, whereas Lebanon mainly was, they were being bombarded by air, and the civilians didn't see the soldiers at all. And the soldiers that were firing missiles from the air also don't see the civilians. So the question is, can we really do this? And if so, how? As soon as the UN resolution took effect at 8 o'clock on Monday morning, August 14th, within minutes, cars of displaced persons were on the road going south, going back to their villages to see what's left of their homes. And so it actually took quite a long time.
This is the ceasefire resolution.
Yes. There were people waving, you know, Hezbollah flags, carrying Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah's photos, and just wanting to go south. Now, when we reached the different villages and we did a tour of the different villages that, and certainly not all of them that were affected, entire villages just wiped out, where you could see nothing but rubble and toys or people's personal belongings just in that rubble.
Did you see people in those villages, and how were they living?
No, those villages that were almost completely destroyed, there weren't really many people in there at the time because they had fled, or the people that had stayed had been killed and the rest had tried to make their way out. We reached some villages that were less heavily damaged but still very visible damage, where some people did stay and others left and were coming back. What I found and what we heard repeatedly was, it's okay. This is they felt like they were fighting a very defensive war, that their land and their country, their freedom was being attacked, and they had to fight in this way. And so if they lost their material possessions, it was okay. And even if they had lost a family member, again, it wasn't a war that they had wanted or that they had started, but it was one that had to be fought in the way that it was. So I remember, in fact, the suburb of Beirut was bombed without any kind of notice or warning from the Israeli military. One building was entirely destroyed, and another two were split in half, and there were over 30 dead just in the hours that I was in the area. And one little girl who was asked by a journalist if she was hurt, and she said she had gotten stitches in her leg and in her shoulders, and her head was wrapped, and she said, you know, I am. And she said, my leg and my shoulders, but it's okay. I'm fine. And she was just very strong. And that is what I heard repeatedly and what I felt from the people. And so while it was devastating, the spirit of the people was also very empowering.
Well, you know, Hueda, the party line here in the United States, voiced by the White House and by the Zionist lobby and by, unfortunately, much of the Jewish leadership in the United States, is that all this was necessary. They justify it morally and legally, that Israel is under attack, and this was a defensive measure.
Here you've had years of resolutions saying, get the heck out of the occupied territories, yeah. And all of a sudden they're justifying this war in part because they claim Lebanon isn't, you know, controlling Hezbollah. I mean, and not complying with the UN resolution. And the duplicity and the dishonesty in the newspapers here about this issue, just remarkable to me.
You know, I think the underlying dishonesty, and I don't know whether you agree with me, is that this war seems to be a proxy war fought for the United States, but using Israeli troops to do it. And I imagine because they think they can get at Syria and Iran that way. What's your thinking on that?
I've definitely heard that, and I think I can say it's for the first time also. I've heard also Lebanese saying this, and also Hezbollah saying that this is also what they believe. Whereas before, Hezbollah blamed the United States for support, unconditionally supporting Israel in Israel's aggression. For the first time, I've heard them say that Israel now is fighting an American war. And so I think that that is a very real possibility and not to be discounted.
If you want to take some action, go to the Amnesty USA website and find the action to help prevent the supply of cluster munitions to Israel. According to the New York Times, the United States is sending a rush delivery of cluster bombs, or at least considering it, to Israel. But I believe they've already sent it, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
To use in their ground offensive in Lebanon. These are inherently indiscriminate weapons that are designed to target everyone. Little bombs sent everywhere over the size of one or two football fields. We ask you to go to amnestyusa.org and take that action.
And what suggestions do you have for our listeners in terms of taking action about this?
The Campaign for Civil Resistance in Lebanon has a website with good information and reports, and that is lebanonsolidarity.org. And in the occupied Palestinian territories, you can go to palsolidarity.org.
Hueda Arif of the International Solidarity Movement, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hueda. That was Hueda Arif, the founder of the International Solidarity Movement, who just returned from Lebanon.
On Law and Disorder, we've been following the NSA spying cases. USA District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor ruled recently that the government's warrantless surveillance program is unconstitutional and ordered an immediate end to it. Taylor is the first judge to strike down the National Security Agency's program, which she said violated the right to free speech and privacy, as well as the constitutional separation of powers. Joining Law and Disorder, we have Melissa Goodman, an attorney from the ACLU, who's been working on the NSA case. Melissa, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We've been following the NSA spying cases very closely, but can you just give a brief synopsis of for people who haven't been following or who may be new to this story of what happened?
Sure. We learned in late 2005 that soon after 9/11, President Bush had basically secretly authorized the NSA to listen in on our phone calls and read our emails without a warrant. And he had done that even though there has been a law in place for 25 years that governs how the president and the executive branch is supposed to listen in on phone calls or read emails between, you know, allegedly suspected terrorists in this country. He decided to ignore that law and instead created the secret program that we didn't learn about, as I said, in 2005. So when the story broke in the New York Times, we quickly tried to learn what was going on, and soon thereafter filed a case in Michigan on behalf of a wide array of journalists, scholars, lawyers who represent suspected, you know, people who are accused of terrorism-related crimes, organizations, you know, who provide support in that area. Basically, all people who regularly make phone calls or send emails to people in the Middle East or people the government has suspected of being engaged in terrorism.
Now, the we is the ACLU, mm-hmm. right? And then there were two or three other cases filed, one
yes.
by my office, I know the Center
mm-hmm.
for Constitutional
the same,
Rights.
Yep.
Another one by EFF, right? A slightly different case.
Slightly different case. And there's also one in Oregon.
EFF is Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yes.
And there's one where else?
In Oregon, filed by the National Lawyers Guild and other people I'm forgetting at the moment.
Yeah, Heidi's not in the studio with us right now, so
right.
she
That's
can,
extremely
yeah.
interesting. That has one variation on it that's
yes.
interesting, is they actually know that their client, I think they know that their client was actually wiretapped on mm-hmm. one of these warrantless surveillance.
It's an interesting twist.
Cases, right.
But yes, the CCR case was filed the same day as ours and quite similar on behalf of lawyers who are harmed by this program. The fight began in all of these cases. And what the government chose to do in our case, in CCR's case, in basically every case about the NSA spying program, they decided instead of fighting to defend why they believed the program was legal, they decided to invoke their new favorite tool in our cases that we're seeing over and over again, called the state secrets privilege. Basically, they came in and said, look, we've created a program that is so secret that not even you, court, can understand everything about it and decide whether it's legal. You have to shut down these cases right now at the outset. In our case, the judge said, well, I'm going to hear arguments about whether this is legal or not. And she said, you know, you have to argue both things. And ultimately, after a couple of arguments, the judge ruled our way and said, first, I reject the idea that the government can come in and block my ability to review the legality of this program in this case of national importance by claiming everything is too secret. She said, everything I need to know about the targeted wiretapping program, which is how the government was listening in on the content of our calls and emails, the government has already admitted, and I don't need any state secrets to say very clearly that it's illegal and that it's unconstitutional. In our cases, we represent the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, many of whom represent, you know, clients in sure. terrorism-related prosecutions. As a result of the program, they can no longer tell their clients for sure that what they're telling them is over the phone or even over email. Now,
that was true, you know, in the cases that we have, which are similar, the mm-hmm. Guantanamo cases, where we represent a lot of CCR attorneys and others. How can we go to our clients now and have any confidentiality to what we mm-hmm. email them or write them? Is protected, and it tells the government everything we want to do.
Exactly.
So, in fact, some of our lawyers have actually had to fly to the other countries to talk to the families, et cetera, mm-hmm. because we're afraid of being wiretapped.
Even more broadly, apart from attorney-client privilege, it really stands democracy on its head, if you think about it. The government's supposed to represent us, not vice versa.
That's very true. And as Michael was saying, I mean, it definitely burdens, you know, as I'm saying, the professional responsibilities that we all have, either as lawyers, as journalists, you know, anyone. You just need to be able to ensure them that their communications are confidential, and there can be incredibly dire consequences. The same is true for some of the academics that we represented. For example, Larry Diamond, who's a scholar at the Hoover Institute, does a lot of work on pro-democracy work in the Middle East and is often going out and talking to people, and they're saying things and criticizing their governments, and if that got out, they could suffer a lot of harm because of it. So it's very important that those communications remain confidential.
So you won this victory from a district court judge. I think she enjoined, actually, mm-hmm. the program, but for some reason the injunction isn't in effect. Tell us what the story is.
Sure. She enjoined the whole program because she said that, it was illegal and because it violated FISA and also because it violated our constitutional rights. We have agreed very temporarily to a stay of that decision. Basically, we just wanted to give the judge time to hear the government's motion to stay the whole proceeding pending appeal. It was just to give her time to hear that argument. What the judge said was actually very simple. She didn't take away any tool that the government needs or has to listen in on conversations between suspected terrorists. They can still do that. All she said was that you have to go get a warrant first. You have to follow the procedure that Congress says you have to follow.
What does the government say the harm is in going to get a warrant? Why can't they do that?
Well, they haven't made those arguments yet. But based on the arguments that they made while we were fighting over whether the program was legal, they actually didn't lay a lot of those arguments out with a great deal of specificity. But their idea is that you have to act quickly. You must always act quickly. And it takes too much time to go get a warrant.
They don't have to get a warrant. They can just do it and then 3 days later say, we did it. Is it okay?
Right. The law now allows them 3 days. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they'd asked for an extension of 7 days.
3 days without a warrant.
They'd asked for 7 days, I think, in some new legislation, which to the extent they really had any bureaucratic issues here. I want to make a comment on the attacks on her, because it reminds me, you know, I clerked for Judge Constance Baker Motley in 1971.
A lovely one.
She was the first black woman federal judge in the United States. And I know Diggs Taylor is also a black woman federal judge, of which there are very, very few. And the common currency in the courthouse down here at Foley Square was that Judge Motley was not smart, that her opinions weren't well written, and they went after her. What they were really going after her for were two things. One is for being a black woman, pioneering judge on that court, and secondly, for not deciding the way the establishment wanted to.
Yes.
She would frequently sentence a white drug dealer to the same sentence that a black guy would get from other judges for cocaine or something. And they would try and reverse her sentences all the time because they didn't like that. So I sense in this Diggs Taylor situation that this is partly about people who don't like the decision and partly about people, I don't like to say, you know, uppity black woman, but I sense that there's some of that going on here.
44, yeah. I think.
Yeah. But I think that it really raises a whole different notion of how the American people are to be governed in the future. And in the past, we saw, however constricted and narrow and faulty this democracy was, there was at least a threat of it. And I think that these Bush people and the people that are attacking the judge for this decision have a whole different notion of the kind of social order and kind of government they want, which is a total top-down kind of totalitarian notion. And I think that's why they're going after her, because she says, look, supposed to be a separation of powers, going all the way back to James Madison. They quoted Madison in the Hamden case. Michael was talking about it 2 weeks ago, saying that if the executive can also legislate and execute the laws, you got a tyranny. That's what Madison said. People like this judge are recognizing this and are trying to uphold democracy in the face of this different notion that these Bush people have about what kind of society they want to create for us. I think this is a real watershed decision.
And it's interesting that actually one of the ways Judge Taylor actually began her decision was by quoting that, statement by Madison, you know, where the concentration of all, this is not a direct quote, you know, concentration of all powers in one person or one arm of our government is, you know, is the very definition
That's
of tyranny.
Correct.
And the main kind of victory in a whole decision like this is that you have a judge, a federal judge, whose entire role in our constitutional system of government is to check the other branches, to make sure that they're not abusing their power, stepping beyond the realms of what the Constitution gives them, and to check them and put them back in line. And that's precisely what she's done.
What happens now? You've won this initial step in a long process. Tell us about the rest of the process.
Well, the government immediately appealed the decision. We'll just fight, you know, the next battle in the Court of Appeals in the Sixth Circuit.
You went to court, you got this great decision. What happens next?
Then the government, or whoever loses, gets to decide whether they want to keep fighting or if they don't. And if they want to keep fighting, they have to file an appeal. And that the government has already done. What happens next is that court, again, the Court of Appeals, will set a schedule, and both of us will fight for an expedited schedule, which means that we will ask the process to happen quickly because it's a case of such national importance. And then three judges in that circuit in the Court of Appeals will hear the case and will decide whether, you know, Judge Taylor's ruling was correct and her findings were correct.
Can you please tell listeners, if they're interested in learning more or taking action, what they can do?
Sure. The best way at the moment is to visit the ACLU's website at www.aclu.org/NSA spying. You should also visit the website of the Center for Constitutional Rights because their case is, I believe you guys have an argument coming up soon.
Right. Early September.
So keep up with that. But on the ACLU website, there's links to actions you can take. There are people in Congress who want to push through this bill that would make this program legal. I don't think they can do it, especially because now, you know, they can't authorize unconstitutional conduct. But nonetheless, they're going to try, and they're going to try very hard before they break again for the elections. So people need to write their congressperson and tell them that it's a terrible idea.
Melissa Goodman of the ACLU, thanks so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder. Congratulations and good luck.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very
thanks,
much, Melissa. You were great. We are also pleased to have with us Shane Katadal, an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has been working on the Center's case involving the NSA warrantless spying.
Shane, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
So we just spoke with Melissa Goodman of the ACLU about their NSA spying lawsuit. Tell us, CCR has a lawsuit about the NSA spying issue. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, you know, it was sort of motivated by the fact that
when the president admitted in response to New York Times revelations that he had actually been carrying out this program of warrantless surveillance and that it had been, you know, according to him, just targeted at international calls, you know, calls from the U.S. to overseas or vice versa, where one party on the phone was, you know, thought to be involved somehow with terrorism. We thought immediately, well, that describes a lot of our calls with our clients because, you know, our clients are all people who the government has unjustly accused of having some link to terrorism. So we represent, you know, all the people swept up in the immigration sweeps after 9/11, all of whom were eventually deported to their home countries. And we have to talk to them, you know, by phone and email to get information that's necessary to litigate their case. The reason we brought the suit was because the administration's description of the people they were targeting seemed to fit, you know, us pretty closely, and therefore we felt we'd have standing to bring the suit in court. But the reality is that when you look at the whole picture, you know, it would have been very easy for the government to get, you know, warrants to listen in on those sorts of calls if they actually had evidence that someone linked to terrorism was on the line. Because the existing statute, FISA, that allows the government to carry out this kind of surveillance is very, very easy for the government to work with. Out of 19,000 requests the government has made over the last couple decades, the court has only turned down 5 requests out of 19,000. When you think about that, I think the real reason that they're going around FISA is not because they're carrying out a targeted program, but it's more likely that they're doing something like listening to every single call.
Shane, I'd like to ask you about where the center's case is, when your argument is.
Sure. Well, within a couple of days, it'll be entirely briefed, meaning the judge will have all the paper filings he needs to decide the case. Then on September 5th, the day after the holiday at 2 p.m., in the Southern District, that's the courthouse down, the federal courthouse in the lower part of Manhattan, Judge Lynch is going to have oral argument in the case. And so, you know, the public is, you know, welcome to attend, and we hope it's a packed courtroom.
When is that now?
It's September 5th, 2006. That's a Tuesday after the Labor Day holiday, and it's 2 p.m.
Thank you very much, Shane, for joining us at Law & Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Law & Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law & Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.